Okay, are we ready? Bright, attentive, alert, here. Fully established. Is the sound okay? Yeah. When I first went to Asia as a teenager in the early 70s, I, like many of my generation at that time in Asia, was desperately in search of the fast track to enlightenment. And in my assumption around that was about finding places to engage in very intensive boot camp style practice. And rather bizarrely, I found myself training with a teacher in the Gelup lineage of Tibetan Buddhism, who actively discouraged us from doing any formal practice for the first year of our training. And when we questioned that, his response was, you know, what would be the point if you don't know why you're practicing? If you don't understand the nature of the path and where it's going, and if you don't understand the teaching that actually informs a path, he said, really, what would be the point? So then the first year of my own training was very much a year spent, you know, with many, many hours on a daily basis listening to the teaching, doing more reflection, doing more investigation. And in retrospect, when I look back on that, I realize how much I really appreciated that introduction, that I felt that I was beginning the path at least with some glimmer of understanding about the why and the how and the wherefore and the where to of the entire practice. I wish I could find a better word for study than study. And I'm still searching, but contemplative inquiry, I think, is a better phrase. I think for many Westerners, the word study has all of these associations of, you know, absorbing information, memorizing, you know, intellectual overload, success and failure. Whereas in the context of the Buddhist teaching, this contemplative inquiry is something very, very different. And when the Buddha speaks about the steps of developing understanding, and he makes a very direct link, by the way, between awakening and understanding. So when he talks about the steps of developing understanding, he speaks about it in these different dimensions. And the first of these is actually to listen to the teaching. You know, that might sound obvious, but it is listening to the teaching that actually begins to change our view. To change our view about, you know, the most helpful way to live, about our views about values, our views about the world, our views about ourselves. It's listening to the teaching that actually begins to shift that view. And that was very evident to me very early on in the teaching when, you know, in my teaching, much of the first year was really spent a lot around ethics and motivation. You know, and I spent quite a few years growing up in Northern Ontario. Now, maybe some of you have done that also. But if you've ever lived in Northern Ontario, you know that there are a lot of things there in nature that are there to vex you, eat you, basically. And so when I was growing up, it was quite normal to go through life just killing things. Everybody killed things, you know? That was normal. You know, I have, you know, very strong images of my mother, you know, chasing around with fly swatters and, you know, frantically killing anything that moved. So, you know, I sort of had this worldview that if something annoyed you, you know, not people, but if something annoyed you, the most appropriate response was to annihilate it. Nobody had ever told me anything different than that. So it was something of a surprise to me, you know, to hear in the teaching that the first thing, that there might be a better way to navigate my way through life than just annihilating things that annoyed me. It was a surprise. That might sound very naive to you, but that was actually my first teaching on ethics. was around non-harming, you know, and finding a different way to interface with the world than one of harm and annihilation. It was something of a surprise to hear, for the first time for me, that there might be a better way to respond to being hurt than with rage or vengeance or retaliation, that compassion might be an option. So listening to the teaching is really the first step of beginning to shift some of the views that we have, often inherited views, but often embedded views that actually we use to guide our way through life, our views about how things are, about how people are, about how the world is, about who we are. Beginning to shift those views. And then the second step of developing understanding is to have an inner investigation, contemplation, to see whether we actually agree with what we've heard. Does this make sense to us in our own experience? Does it strike a chord? Does it inspire us? And then the third step, of course, is the one of that experiential investigation to know this teaching in our bones and to know how to embody it in our lives. So this is not just a sort of intellectual piece of knowledge, but beginning with shifting our view, having that experiential agreement, understanding, and then that step of embodiment is actually really what the path is about. And I know this is, you know, again, you know, I hold myself partially responsible for this because, as you know, one of the teachers who first established centers in the West and started teaching, the first thing we did was establish retreat centers. You know, go sit, you know, go walk, you know, without realizing that we were kind of in many ways passing on a model that sort of extracted the formal practice out of the whole of the path and said, you know, this is what really has value, rather than the understanding and the contemplation and the investigation. So in these later years of my teaching life, I'm shifting that emphasis, and I'd like us really to engage in a path of really informed mindfulness and informed practice of really understanding what we do. The Buddha said, you know, that without this understanding, he used the parable of a group of people who couldn't see touching different parts of an elephant, and, you know, one saying the leg, oh, this is the elephant, and one saying the trunk, oh, no, this is the elephant, and, you know, one saying the hide, no, this is the elephant, and none of them having a sort of overall picture of what the elephant was actually all about, not just pieces of it. I think really part of this step of embodiment is also contextualizing our practice. A reminder of something that is really, I think, too important to forget, that we actually don't engage in this path just for our own benefit. You know, we engage with this path in order to understand, you know, how to be ethically awake human beings, to understand how we interface with the world around us, to recognize that we are always touching the world in some way, just as we are being touched by the world. And, you know, it's easy to forget that as much as the Buddha was a contemplative, he was also really much a social activist. You know, deeply engaged with actually changing the culture that he lived in and, you know, correcting as much as he could the injustices and the inequalities that he encountered. So as we engage in this practice, you know, we do, yes, for our own benefit, but for the benefit of those we love, those we don't know, those we struggle with, for the kind of footprint that we leave upon the world, or how we touch the world around us. There's a wonderful Tibetan quote that says, you know, this mind, this body, does the bidding of the wholesome and the unwholesome. guided by confusion, this mind, this body, ties us to circles of distress and confusion. Guided by understanding, this mind, this body, is a raft to liberation. So it's really recognizing that embodiment is as much a part of this path, and I like to talk about path rather than practice. Embodiment is as much a part of this path as anything we do on a cushion or a walking path. So to actually begin to explore some of the material I want to touch upon today. Mentioned it when we began that the Buddha translates as one who is awake. But very clearly in his teaching life, the Buddha didn't describe wakefulness as a state, but as an embodiment of understanding. I think many of us hear about, you know, the night of the Buddha's awakening, you know, and his Bodhi tree moment, you know, and think that this is the point of what we do here, is to find our own Bodhi tree moment. But the point of what we do here is actually to develop the understanding that frees, the understanding that brings dukkha or struggle or distress to an end. And the Buddha talked about many, many different pathways to awakening. Talked about the cultivation of the Brahmaviharas, of metta, compassion, joy, equanimity, as direct pathways to liberating the heart. Talked about liberating the heart through understanding emptiness, shunya or shunyata. And one of the pathways found most strongly in the Satipatthana Sutta, is everyone here, because I'll be referring to this, does everyone here know or are familiar with the Satipatthana discourse? Anyone not? Anyone not? Please don't be shy. Okay. The Satipatthana discourse is probably one of these seminal discourses in the early texts that really outlines the pathways of developing what we call mindfulness. And this is where, you know, and as many of you know, the Buddha often presents his teaching in a series of lists. You know? This is not an accident. We have to remember that for 500 years after the Buddha's death, this was an oral tradition. You know, and in oral traditions, one of the good ways of remembering things is through lists. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, we find this list of qualities that are referred to the seven limbs, or the seven supports of awakening. The Pali word is bhajangas. They sometimes are described as the seven precious treasures. They ennoble our lives, and their cultivation holds within these seven qualities a complete path of awakening. And of course, these qualities are not just cultivated on a meditation cushion. These qualities are very much cultivated in the midst of our lives, within all of the conditions of our lives that we can't control and often can't predict. So the Buddha said of these seven supports or limbs of awakening that when they're cultivated and brought to maturity, they free the mind heart from all forms of bondage and suffering. They incline the mind towards liberation, and they are to be cultivated. So this is first one of the words I'd like to clarify. This word meditation, so difficult, you know. Again, this is very much a borrowed word that has been used to translate what in the text is referred to as bhavana. The Pali word is bhavana. We translate it as meditation, unfortunately. Its actual translation means to cultivate or to bring into being, to nurture. Any of you, whoever grows anything, you know, whether you're growing a child or, you know, a vegetable or an art in your life, knows that to grow anything, you need to cultivate it. You need to bring it into being. It's why, you know, I think this word meditation is such a difficult translation of this, you know, because when we think of meditation, we often think of, you know, sitting with our eyes closed in a certain posture, you know, practicing. How often do we think of cultivating? What is being cultivated in that posture or in the walking posture? What is being cultivated? So these are ways, these seven qualities are actually ways of training the heart, training the mind, inclining the mind towards liberation. I just give you an overview of these qualities, okay, just so that you kind of have a sense of what I'm talking about. Some of you will be familiar with them. The first of these is mindfulness or sati. The second of these is investigation. The third of these is energy. The fourth of these is joy. The next one is tranquility. The next one is samadhi or collectedness. And the last of these is equanimity. Okay. So this is what we are engaged with cultivating. And the Buddha said actually we should really reflect whenever, wherever we are in our life, whatever we are practicing, whatever we are doing, to be aware of what is being cultivated. Because we need to be mindful that we cultivate the unwholesome as much as the skillful. We cultivate habit as much as we cultivate wakefulness. In every moment of our lives, we are always practicing something. Okay, so the other part of this cultivation that I think is really, I feel it's something so important to mention, is cultivation reorients our approach to the path. You know, I think it's a particularly Western trait where the word meditation has become equated or used interchangeably with the word work. It only happens in this culture, by the way. I'm working on things. You know, I'm working on my, you know, I'm working on my rage, I'm working on my greed, I'm working on my impatience, I'm working on my judgment, you know, I'm working on this. And how many people in my experience, when I speak to them in teaching, they come with a project of what they're working on. And somehow within that there's some kind of hidden notion that by working on all these imperfections there will be a reward. And the reward is, you know, we're going to be more perfect, or we're going to be happier at least, or we're going to be purer, or something. There's an idea that the rewards rest upon us working on things or working things out. Is that unfamiliar to anyone? You actually don't find this within the teaching, that this is something to do. And, you know, we're good workers as Westerners. You know, we have a good work ethic. You know, we get busy, you know. But have you ever noticed that the success rate is quite low? You know, I've worked on my impatience, and up pops the greed, and I work on that, and then up pops the jealousy, you know. And so it seems like the projects are somewhat endless. And, you know, that's a very important revelation to hold close to yourself, that the projects are endless. And the worst of these projects is, I'm going to let go. Have you ever told yourself you really should let go of something? It's even worse when somebody else tells you you should let go of something. Have you ever noticed how really, really unsuccessful that command system is? You know? I don't know if we're ever... We can be successful at restraining things. This I would say. But certainly in the Buddha's teaching, letting go is not an act of will. It's not an act of will. that the unbinding that we long for and wish for, the freedom that we long for and wish for, is actually born of the cultivation of the skillful and the wholesome. Okay? That it is the cultivation of those qualities that free the mind that actually has the effect of unbinding from that which distresses us. So in that, you know, there's a very clear encouragement in the early teachings to reorient our attention, to incline the mind towards what is being cultivated in terms of the skillful and the wholesome, rather than highlighting and the imperfect and the unskillful as projects that we're going to work on. This shouldn't be actually news to anyone. I'm sure you have all had moments in your practice life or in your ordinary life where the mind can be feeling quite troubled or agitated, anxious, and a difficult thought or image or memory comes along and it just sticks. It's like the conditions are absolutely right for it to stick and be contracted around. I'm sure you've all experienced moments too when the mind, the heart, has felt more spacious, more steady, more calmer, stiller, and exactly the same thought or image can come along and it just moves right on through. And what's the difference? The difference is not in the contents of the mind. The difference is in the climate of the mind, heart, in which those contents appear. So what we're doing is cultivating the climate of mind and heart that is inclined towards unbinding, inclined towards non-stickiness. This is a really important shift, I think, in approaching this path. To really have that real deep understanding of the power of cultivation and what the effect it has upon us. Okay, so let's put these qualities of awakening into context. I mean, they are mentioned in many, many of the discourses, and they occupy a very, very central place in this teaching of the Satipatthanas, the ways of establishing mindfulness. Some of you who are familiar with this discourse may have found yourself feeling puzzled at the fourth way of establishing mindfulness. You know, the first three are kind of evident, you know, body, feeling tone, mind states, you know, and then you come to the fourth way of establishing mindfulness and you get confronted by these lists, you know, Four Noble Truths, the Five Aggregates, the Six Sense Doors. The consensus amongst translators and scholars that the only thing that is congruent in all of the different translations of the Satipatthana, the Chinese, the Pali, and the Sanskrit, that the only thing that is congruent are the seven limbs of awakening and the five hindrances. Okay, so I think it's just good to recognize that. So, the seven factors, or the seven limbs or supports of awakening, they are relational qualities. So what you see in the Satipatthana are these two lists sitting side by side. The list of the five hindrances that I will refer to as the forgetfulness factors, and the seven supports of awakening. And these two are sitting side by side. I think we experience this in our lives, how these two lists sit side by side. You know, we have intentions, we have aspirations, we have longings, and we forget them. And what we actually see is that there is a certain tension involved in waking up. You know, good intentions are not enough. There's a certain tension involved in waking up. And have you experienced this in your life? You know, that you have a really wholesome intention, a really skillful intention, and then suddenly you find yourself pulled into the field of habit, and that intention just gets sabotaged. You know, like maybe you get up in the morning and you really have the intention, you know, to really practice some wise speech with your partner or people that, you know, you meet on the street, you know, to be a relatively sane human being until they leave their dirty teacup around or something. And suddenly you find yourself pulled into that reactivity of aversion and your intention is entirely forgotten. You know, you have the intention to go out into your day, you know, reasonably patient, inclusive, you know, until, you know, conditions suddenly are unpleasant. You know, the bus is late. You know, and we immediately get pulled into some very familiar habit pattern and those intentions are sabotaged. I mean, do you recognize this pull? How this pull between our aspirations and the pull of many of our psychological and emotional habits. You know? I'm sure this is not news to anyone. And when we experience that, you know, I think there's a danger of becoming very judgmental. You know, I'm so forgetful. You know, I just can't sustain an intention. You know, we're aware of this dissonance between our intentions and what we're actually embodying in our speech or in our actions and our choices. And it can become the ground for a sense of despair or failure or judgment. You know, if I was a better meditator, you know, I wouldn't do this. You know? So it's very easy to regard this tension as a kind of a negative tension, whereas in my mind, this is actually the classroom of our path. This is our classroom. This is not a negative tension. This is actually a creative tension. This is actually where we learn to begin to wake up and to be aware of what it is that we are cultivating, you know, where we are, what we are really nurturing and bringing into being. So I would really encourage you not to think of this tension as being, you know, something to get over or to get rid of, but to really recognize this is our classroom. This is really our classroom. This is where we really train our hearts to cultivate and to sustain the qualities that really unbind, rather than cultivating and sustaining the habit patterns of mind that do bind. So there's an ongoing dialogue, I would say, between these seven qualities or supports of awakening and these five, what are called, hindrances. When I say hindrances is not a good translation. I mean, by the way, these are also not news to anybody. The more accurate translation is that these are veiling factors. It's like if I threw a cloth over this microphone, it would be hard to see it very clearly. So they're kind of veiling our capacity to see things as they actually are. They're distorting factors. Now, these five distorting factors, let's be clear about these. These are, again, very familiar in our emotional, psychological landscape. There's the craving for sensual pleasure, and I'm going to go into these a bit more. There's the veiling factor of aversion. There's the veiling factor of numbness or dissociation or dullness. You know, there's the veiling factor of restlessness and worry, and the veiling factor of doubt. So when we look at these veiling factors, you know, in this, we sometimes, well, we see them sometimes as just moods or mental states, you know, just kind of averse of today, or I'm just very anxious today, you know, I'm just very doubting today. But what we actually see is that when moods are repeated often enough, they become patterns. They become psychological or emotional habits that the mind inclines towards. So these five veiling factors actually span both the third way of establishing mindfulness and the fourth. And the difference is you repeat a mood often enough and it becomes a pattern. And patterns, I'm sure we recognize, get built into identity. They get built into a sense of self. I'm an anxious type. I'm an aversive type. you know, or I'm a greedy type. So I think it's really helpful for us to see that in our own experience, the way that, you know, if you repeat a mood often enough without awareness, it becomes embedded, it becomes a neural pathway. It's much easier to repeat it again. And if we repeat it a sufficient number of times, it becomes who we are. So we're going to spend a little bit of a time to with the bad news first, okay? Because I think it's, you know, so many people I find in meditative practice, kind of, they hear this stuff about the five hindrances, and especially if you're an experienced student, your eyes kind of glaze over, you know. You think, well, I know this, you know, it's just something to get over. You know, and oh yeah, these are meditative problems. You know, these are meditative problems to get over so I can really begin practicing once they're gone. You know? These are not meditative problems. Hmm? These are life challenges. Hmm? If you look at any psychological or emotional storm that you experience, you're going to find it patterned with these veiling factors of aversion or craving or anxiety or doubt. You're going to find it them patterned with these. So the practice doesn't begin when these have gone away. These actually really are much of the landscape within which we are cultivating the reorientation towards cultivating the wholesome factors, okay? So it's also very important to recognize in Buddhist psychology these five veiling factors, there's a continuum here. I'm going to use the word hindrances even though I'm not very fond of it because veiling factors just takes up too much tongue space. these five hindrances are a continuum. The five hindrances are said to be a continuum of greed, hatred, and delusion. These are the five manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion. And as far as the Buddha was concerned, it's greed, hatred, and delusion that keeps us spinning in circles of repeating distress. Hmm? But greed, hatred, and delusion are the three manifestations of what in Buddhist teaching is called avidya, or ignorance, or confusion. Simply not knowing things the way that they actually are. But, you know, we don't see ignorance, do we? We don't see it. I mean, if you look inwardly and say, well, where's the ignorance hiding? You know, you actually don't see it. We actually know confusion when it begins to erupt. And the way that it begins to erupt are often through greed, hatred, and delusion. But again, they can be so compulsive and so driven that we don't know them. But the place where we actually can begin to access what it is that's creating distress is through these five hindrances. Because these, are, unfortunately, are accessible in too many moments of our day. I mean, just check in for a moment. You know, it's not like they're always present. They're certainly not always present. They're often dissociative mechanisms, aren't they? These are the ways that we dissociate from what we don't like, what we don't want. You know, and it, we can check in right now. You know, is there some craving for sensual pleasure? You know, is the mind thinking about, you know, the brownie at lunchtime, you know, or, you know, I'd like to see a bit more of the deer, you know, what am I doing in here, you know. Is there some sense of aversion? Am I kind of struggling with this uncomfortable chair, or, you know, what happened before I left the house this morning, you know, or, you know, something that I've got to do at the end of the day, you know. Is there some dullness present, you know? Is there some kind of numbness present as a mood, you know? Is there any kind of agitation, restlessness, or worry, you know, lingering at the edges of your consciousness? You know, is there some sense of doubt? You know, this developing this kind of literacy is really important in the process of awakening. You know, that we don't feel bewildered, that things don't happen to us, that we have enough emotional literacy to actually read these moods or these patterns as they arise. So what we see is that these patterns, or what we call the five hindrances, these are the basic saboteurs of intention. These are what sabotage us. These are what hijack our intentions. Our intentions to be awake, to be caring, to be compassionate, to be responsive, to be creative. This is really what hijacks our intentions. So when I spoke this earlier on this morning about the one of the keys of meditative deepening is the ability to sustain mindfulness, the ability to sustain attention. I think most of us experience that the journey from applied attention to sustained attention is actually a journey through these hindrances. So really important to recognize that. Okay, so let's just think about them. Sensual craving doesn't sound so bad, does it? Can govern a whole lot of our attentional focus. You know, I think we probably recognize how much of our attention is stimulation-bound attention. You know, things wake us up. We want to be stimulated. We treasure the feeling of being awake, but we rely upon stimulation to help us feel awake. Okay, does that ring any bells? So just think about this craving for sensual pleasure, what a habit pattern it is. Have you noticed when you move around this building, or you move through your day, or you move in the garden, how the eyes are often in a state of ongoing hunger? You know? What can I look at that feels good? You know? What can I see? You know, what can I peruse? You know, that actually makes me feel more stimulated, more awake, more alive. This is a huge part of the Buddhist teaching of liberation, is to actually to really recognize that the craving for sensual pleasure does not actually deliver the lasting happiness we really seek for. It's such a key part. It's not a denial of sensual appreciation. That is a very different territory. You know, and I think in the teaching there's a huge encouragement to develop our capacity for sensual appreciation, to have the mind gladdened by what is lovely. This is a crucial distinction to make. You know, I've seen, you know, too many practitioners not make that distinction and get into kind of life denial, world denial positions, you know, that if I'm going to be a Buddha, I have to cut out everything lovely in my life. This is not the teaching. Sensual appreciation is a moment of arising. You know, we meet something that's lovely, we see something that's lovely, we hear something that's lovely, and we know how to appreciate, how to respond with sensitivity. But we don't. The moment that it turns into, how can I keep this, how can I have more of this, it has turned into sensual craving. It's not allowing things to pass. It's turned into sensual craving. The, you know, the image that's used in some of the Buddhist artwork is the image of the hungry ghost. You know, the beings who kind of move through the world, you know, with these very tiny pinprick mouths and these very tiny throats and these huge distended stomachs, you know, who can actually never satisfy themselves. I think this actually accounts for a lot of the distractedness that we find ourselves experiencing in life. You know, in a way we're just not content with what is. You know, so we get busy, and particularly our sense doors get busy. And it's not just about what we do with our eyes. Think about what we do with our attention inwardly. You ever found yourself sitting, you know, you're a bit discontented, you know, a bit bored maybe, you know, doesn't feel that exciting. I have a little fantasy. little fantasy, a little, you know, romantic planning, you know. It's something just to keep me entertained. Just to keep me entertained. Now, the reason why the Buddha put so much emphasis on understanding this impulse towards sensual craving and the effect that it has on our life is the way that it manifests so much confusion. And the basic confusion it manifests is that happiness is externally generated. You know, that joyfulness is externally generated. That my happiness as a human being is dependent somehow on having the maximum amount of pleasant conditions and the minimum amount of unpleasant conditions. So the way the Buddha is really questioning the way that we've invested our capacity for happiness into getting things, keeping things, you know, and how that sensual craving can manifest in so many areas of life and how it really operates on a deficit system and reinforces a deficit system, you know, that I am not enough, I don't have enough in order to be happy, content, at ease with what is. You think of the way this makes us hostage to the world of conditions, how this binds us to the world of conditions, always trying to manage conditions so that I have, you know, no discomfort and maximum pleasure. This is it can be a very busy life, and it can be a very reinforcing a sense of insufficiency or deficit inwardly. So the Buddha didn't suggest, you know, he said this is to be understood. He said this is not something to be condemned, you know, this is not something to be dismissed or overridden. This is something to be understood, to understand the way that sensual, the compulsion towards sensual craving, to understand how it is implicated in the creation of distress and unease. Okay. He didn't suggest that we just suddenly suppress this or override it, but he actually did suggest, you know, some restraint here is quite valuable. Some restraint around the sense doors is actually quite valuable. Often one of the images that I'll get into later is the way that mindfulness is portrayed as learning to be our own gatekeeper. And part of what we're being the gatekeeper of is actually our sense doors, including the sense door of the mind. You know, when we see ourselves really involved in that compulsive kind of prowling the world for something to interest us or stimulate us or awaken us, it can be quite useful to pause and just ask ourselves, what in this moment is actually lacking? Where is the contentment to be found in this moment? How can we heighten the level of sensitive appreciation as a means of lowering the compulsion of sensual craving? To really begin to question this compulsion. Moment of pause. Anybody got any questions, reflections around this one? Yeah.
I know yoga philosophy better than Buddhist philosophy, and there's a word, santosha, contentment.
Enchantment?
Contentment.
Cultivate
contentment.
It's very similar to the question was around in the yoga tradition, the emphasis that is placed upon the cultivation of contentment. This is also quite central to Buddhist psychology. In fact, you know, in the Vinaya, in people who are, or say take up a monastic life, it's often portrayed as the cultivation of the great contentments. you know, to be content with whatever clothing you are given or none at all, you know, to be content with whatever accommodation you're given or none at all, you know, to be content with whatever food you are given or none at all, and to find contentment in seeing the falling away of the difficult. Anything else up for you? Are you with me? Yeah.
No, I really appreciate you saying it's not a denial of sensual appreciation. To me, that's very critical, because sensual pleasure is just on its own. My rebellion isn't. Beauty has a purpose of ennobling us, right? So I really appreciate that differentiation and that clarification about that. And the craving, that is such an insight for me, because it, you know, I've always had lots of feelings of a lack. I want this, or I need this, I need this before I can be happy. And to have those things, and then that's not it. And it can be an endless search. So I really get this one.
Yeah. Just mentioning, really getting the power of sensual craving, and actually how it really is, it's so interesting the way that we use sensual craving as a means to solve the dilemma of unsatisfactoriness, you know? If I feel discontented, you know, or, you know, upset, or I'm going to use craving as a means of solving that distress. Right? You know this one, you know, I'm a little bored, you know, it's very easy, I just open the fridge, you know, turn on the TV, you know, I'm a little discontented, I just, you know, find something to excite me, you know. The way that we use sensual craving as a mechanism, a problem-solving mechanism, rather than appreciating the way that sensual craving is actually so implicated in the problem that we're actually experiencing. I mean, this is the piece that's really important to get, because it and I'm not talking about these huge sensual cravings. I'm just talking about, you know, these momentary compulsions we have, just to fix that bit of discomfort by replacing it with something that looks better. You know, so it's actually really important to see the way that we use sensual craving as a problem-solving mechanism, when it is actually implicated in the problem. Because what we're doing every time we follow that loop is we're actually reinforcing that ideology of lack. You know, and it's very important here, another distinction to make, because, you know, I mean, I've tried to make the distinction between sensual craving and sensual appreciation. It's also important to make the distinction between sensual craving and what are called kusala chanda, wholesome desire, you know, it's wholesome desire that brings you here, you know, it's wholesome desire or noble desire, ennobling desires that lead us to reach out, to serve and to help, that, you know, bring aspiration into our lives, you know. So also very important to make that distinction, you know, because, you know, sensual craving is a creature unto itself, and not to be confused with either wholesome, skillful desire or sensual appreciation. It's the one that just keeps us busy and keeps us discontented. So the question is whether the sensual craving is also part of the cycle of a sense of failure. Well, yes, it is. You know, because it has a built-in failure mechanism. You know, I think my happiness is dependent on becoming this or getting this, having this. I may have some moments, maybe even long moments of feeling, ha! You know, and then suddenly there's a sense of disappointment, and I didn't do it right, or I didn't go for the right thing, or I didn't become the right kind of person. You know, I think there's something here about learning the wisdom of disappointment. in a sense, you know, when I think of the story that we inherit of the Buddha, you know, I think he was a very disappointed young man when he began his path, you know, because when he began his path, he basically had in place what his society at that time encouraged to get in place. You know, he had stature, he had identity, you know, he had enough provision to, you know, a pleasant phenomena around him, and actually discovered actually that it wasn't delivering, you know, the kind of lasting happiness, peace, freedom that he longed for. There's a way of interpreting disappointment as failure. I didn't do it right, or I didn't go for the right things. And there's a way of reading disappointment actually as bringing us closer to more ennobling longings and aspirations. Yes, Teresa.
Christina, sometimes I experience confusion around, there can be a desire to renounce things, but then there can be kind of a tendency to isolation or to reject.
Well, so the question is that, you know, the relation or the nearness of the desire to renounce something and the tendency to isolate or reject. I would say that that tendency to isolate or reject is actually the near enemy of renunciation. That, you know, I have seen, you know, too many times that I would wish to remember, where renunciation is kind of used as a justification or as a way of turning away from things, and of turning away from things that either we don't want to be with or find it hard to be with or don't like. And you see this in many, many traditional Buddhist cultures, you know, if I dare say so, you know, particularly monastic cultures. You know, where, yes, I'm a renunciate, but actually I'm actually just very dismissive, you know, and or very condemning or very rejecting of something. But it looks like renunciation. So I think it's a near enemy to be really, really careful of, the way that renunciation can actually be, if it's not understood clearly, can be an aversion mechanism. Yeah, I mean, it's also very important to recognize, you know, certainly in Buddhist psychology, the way that renunciation is taught is as an act of compassion, and as actually is something that brings more freedom and more joy, rather than as something that brings distress and contractedness. Okay, just to reflect a little bit more, as renunciation is an act of compassion. Well, you think about renunciation is not about things. Renunciation is about the tendency to contract and to hold and to grip. Okay? Because that tendency to contract around or identify with or grip can land anywhere. It can land around thoughts or identities. It can land around objects, it can land around events and experiences. So renunciation is not about the sort of things that we renounce. It's about unbinding that tendency to contract and identify and grip and clench around things. Because whenever we actually see that tendency in our life, it is not a place of happiness, it is not a place of ease, it is not a place of well-being, it is a place really of distress. So renunciation is really about sort of open, you know, the compassion of renunciation is really about caring for the well-being and the easefulness that is so undermined by that clenching tendency.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. Do I think it's natural for the mind to want to be stimulated all the time? No, I don't. No, I don't. I think this is symptomatic of an untrained mind. You know, I mean, it's not that we avoid stimulation. Stimulation comes to us because we're always being touched by the world, you know. So it's not a question of trying to deny that reality. You know, we sit here or we walk outside. There's sounds, there's sights, you know, there's touches. You know, that's what it means to be a sensual being, is to be in relationship with the world of sensory objects that do stimulate us. But I think the craving to be stimulated all the time is something else. And I think that's a kind of a compulsion that is really born of really not being at ease with ourselves, not being at ease with stillness, not being at ease with contentment, you know, feeling that somehow our well-being relies upon this always being full somehow, or being, you know, prodded continually. You know, and you know, I think there's plenty of research that tells us, you know, our sort of technologically based world is feeding that compulsion that we only feel awake when we're actually being stimulated. It's the root of a lot of addictive patterns. Yes, please.
When you said earlier about taking a pause and then asking the question, where is the contentment to be found?
Yeah.
I was wondering if there was a way to practice with the body there?
Absolutely. When I mentioned, you know, to sometimes just to take upon ourselves the question of where is the contentment just now, how we might actually, you know, engage with the body in that cultivation, very much so, you know, because, I mean, you have to consider, you know, the sort of, well, you know, let's say, you know, in terms of attention training, we actually know psychologically that we're actually prone to highlight the imperfect rather than what is well. You know, we're prone to highlight what is wrong rather than what is well. I mean, there's reasons for that in terms of evolutionary science, but there's not so many reasons now. And I think that, you know, it's still so much part of our psychological patterning is to really highlight the imperfect and to highlight what is unwell. And actually, you know, the reason why the Buddha put the body so much at the center of developing mindfulness is you know, this is a place where we can really begin to explore the territory of coexistence. You know, that something might hurt in the body, you know, maybe my back hurts or my knee hurts, and I see the way that my attention is drawn into that and drawn towards that and begins to contract around it. And yet in that same moment, you know, the palm of my hand is really well. The palm of my hand is really easeful. You know, so it's not about a denial of what may be amiss or wrong, but to recognize in every moment of our lives there is coexistence. And when we preference our attention habitually only to what is wrong or imperfect, we actually don't really cultivate that capacity and the easefulness that comes with actually connecting with what is actually quite well just now. You know, and the body can be a really powerful classroom for that exploration. So it's not about making this sort of either or, you know, I'm either everything's right or everything's wrong. You know, either everything's, you know, imperfect, everything's perfect. It's actually really acknowledging that coexisting nature and being aware of where we're preferencing our attention span. When the Buddha spoke of these five veiling factors, he referred to them as being the generators of mental illness. That's how seriously he took them. But he also spoke of them as being at the root of much of our narrative generation. You can actually see, you know, when there's a lot of craving for sensual pleasure, or where there's a lot of aversion, or doubt, or restlessness and worry, or sloth, or dullness and numbness. These are big story creators. They're big narrative generators. And we're probably aware at this point in our life how much of our narrative is also a self generator, an identity generator. So it's really important, you know, when we actually see ourselves kind of really lost in a big narrative, a big story, it can actually be quite helpful as a sort of meditative investigation to begin to see, well, is one of these veiling factors really fueling that, you know, as a mind state or as a pattern? You know, I remember once teaching a retreat and somebody reported to me, you know, how they'd spent the morning sort of, you know, kind of running around the house, caught between craving for sensual pleasure and restlessness and worry, because it's quite good to recognize that these hindrance factors are always fueling each other. And she said that when she got to the point that she was actually reading the instructions on the fire extinguisher, that it did dawn upon her that something was really going on here. And she said the first instruction apparently on all fire extinguishers is aim the nozzle at the base of the fire. So she said that it was an epiphany moment of actually realizing, you know, that maybe one of these hindrance factors as a mind state or a pattern was really, you know, driving all of this kind of compulsive busyness that she'd been engaged in the entire morning. So it's quite good, actually, when we find ourselves in one of those storms to begin to really pause and ask, you know, what if these factors are really involved here, you know? How do I sense that, you know? What's the felt sense of that discontent that's driving craving for sensual pleasure? Because craving for sensual pleasure, we don't experience it as a mood, we experience it as an activity. But there is a mood behind that activity. And invariably the mood is one of some level of discontent. Things are not just good enough right now. If we find ourselves in, you know, it's quite good to get a felt sense of what is that mood? How do I know that? Where does it register in the body? You know, what is the sense of this? You know, if we find ourselves in one of those aversion storms, you know, to again, to be able to pause, you know, pick up the clues. You know, the clues are often the repeated emotional currency of our thinking patterns. You know, the clues may be very somatic, you know, how this is felt in the body. Ah, how do I know this? How do I know this? You know, it's really seeing that's the moment where we begin to cultivate something else. And actually one of the bhujangas, the awakening factor of investigation, how we begin to cultivate that in the midst of these storms. So the second of these veiling factors, I'm sure is not, again, news to anyone, the mood and the pattern of ill will or aversion. And this is such a spectrum word, isn't it, aversion? You know, it includes pretty much all the difficult, you know, judgment, jealousy, resentment, envy, impatience, frustration, blame, condemnation, shame, guilt. This is all part of the aversion spectrum. It's not just about not liking things, you know. It's about the kind of way that the imperfect is being solidified and reified and reacted to in ourselves, in others, in life, you know. And we see, you know, I mean, we see the toxicity of it, don't we? Not just inwardly, but in our world, in our relationships with others, in the way that aversion and ill will is implicated in the creation of self and other. Yeah? The creation of self and other. And the other is sometimes internal. You know, the thoughts, the emotions we reject and feel ashamed about, the chronic pain, the illness. You know, so sometimes the other is created inwardly, and sometimes the other is created outwardly. The other that we mistrust, feel suspicious of, blame, shame, and, you know, we are all too aware of how this self and othering is becoming almost naturalized. in our vocabulary, in our way of seeing, in our way of thinking, and appreciating the enormous distress and suffering that is born of ill will and aversion. You know, we can maybe think, like the little bouts of irritation we experience. We might think, well, they don't really matter. You know, I can just ignore those. I don't think we can afford to, because I think that, you know, those little bouts of irritation and impatience that we might think make no difference, I think they're all the arms and legs of the one body of ill will. You know, and it's kind of like we practice them and we get better at them and they become patterns and they become, distortions, distorting our way of seeing. Certainly in the Buddha's teaching, you know, he was all too aware that the way in which ill will poisons societies and relationships, you know, communities, families. And he said, we really need to get our attention around this in a caring way, in an understanding way, to understand the ways of how much ill will is born of fear, the fear of injury, the fear of being hurt, the fear of being rejected, how it's almost the automaticity of the reactivity to that fear of injury that gets our minds moving down the pathways of ill will. And again, this is a pattern that doesn't ask, you know, for more aversion. You know, it doesn't help us to have aversion for aversion. You know, but it is a pattern that so deeply asks for understanding and for healing. Again, you know, from the perspective of evolutionary science, there are roots of aversion and ill will, but that's not any longer the roots of most of the aversion and ill will we experience today. It is simply the self-protective mechanism of a self that we believe to be so solid and reliable and reified, you know, that is, you know, needs that kind of protection rather than it needs understanding. It's the little moments, you know, that we practice in. I think it's really the little moments that we develop, in the little moments that we develop the skills and the capacities for actually being more present with the big moments of ill will and fear. Remembering that fear is in this landscape of aversion in Buddhist psychology. It's not a separate phenomena. So it's in those little moments that I think we really do develop the skills for meeting, you know, a lot of life challenges that can trigger so quickly that reactivity pattern of pushing away and rejecting and turning away from. And you can really see how mindfulness is really used as really the first step of disentangling and unbinding from the pattern of ill will, because, you know, if you look at the pattern of ill will, it's so much, it's to turn away from, isn't it? It's to turn away from. Whereas if we look at the pattern of mindfulness, if we've described it as a pattern, it is to turn towards. It's to turn towards that which we're more habitually turning away from. So just a real encouragement to actually really sense, you know, both the murmurs of ill will, the murmurs of our ill will, and how you know, we're very generous with ill will, aren't we? I mean, we like to share. It gets moved through our body and our speech and our choices, you know, and our acts, you know. How, you know, in a single day, how that movement is happening and how that binds us to suffering, you know, how it binds us to alienation and distress, you know. And this, again, this is something to be healed. It's something to be understood. You know? It's not something to be ashamed of. It's something to be healed and understood. I want to whip through these because otherwise I'm going to run out of time this weekend. Sorry. The third of these, interesting, often translated as sloth and torpor. It's such a sort of antiquated term, isn't it? We don't mean, it's about dissociation. It's about dissociative mechanisms. I mean, there are levels of honest fatigue in our lives. You know, we're overextended, or we've been ill, or, you know, we've had a lot of life demands. There are things of honest fatigue. You know, and, you know, I've seen where, you know, part of that honest fatigue is often part of a healing mechanism. You know, someone who's just post-surgery, you know, they're dull, you know, and it's often a way of actually moving into recovery, you know. They need to conserve the energy inwardly, you know. But I think what is spoken about in this mood, this mind state, and this habit pattern is much more the habit pattern of numbing out. In fact, it's kind of one of the aversive mechanisms. You know, it just feels flatter. It doesn't feel charged. But it is still an aversive mechanism of how we just kind of dissociate or numb out. And this mechanism is not just... And again, you can see at times in people's lives, you know, children who are in abuse situations or trauma situations, dissociation has been a survival mechanism, a necessary one. You know, it's more when it becomes a habit pattern, simply because our attention level and our interest level and our engagement level has collapsed and we dissociate. You know, and again, this is coming back to pointing out, you know, how much of our attention level is really stimulation bound, and that when the stimulation is withdrawn, how our attention level often collapses. You know, you certainly, I'm sure many of you have experienced this if you've been on retreats, you know, how you can sleep through the first 3 days. You're not even tired. You've had a good night's sleep. You know, you're not even tired. You're still sleeping for the first 3 days, you know. And it's kind of like it's a withdrawal symptom. You know, it's a withdrawal from that life of stimulation and busyness, and the mind doesn't quite know what to do with that, so it just checks out. Just checks out. But also it's a way of not feeling. It's a way of not feeling. And that's why sometimes it's so associated with the aversive mechanisms, you know, because it's a way of not feeling. And for it's often motivated by not wanting to feel discomfort. But actually, when we dissociate from feeling discomfort, we also dissociate from feeling that which is lovely, you know, because it doesn't really have a choice menu. You know, it is just dissociation. It's interesting. I mean, this morning I was talking about development of attention, but there's actually three factors in developing skillful attention. It's not only intention and attention. It's also interest. It's also curiosity. It's also engagement. You know, it's so easy, isn't it? You know, we have really kind of two primary modes of attention that we're familiar with in our life. Maybe this is a detour. No, it has something to do with this. One of our primary modes of attention we very, very much know is our narrative mode. You know, we have a story about everything. We have a commentary about everything. It's how we know the world. You know, we describe it according to how we've experienced it in the past. You know, so we have a narrative-based mode of attending to the present moment. You know, it's this, it's that. You know, it has a history, it has a future. Our second mode of attending to the present moment tends to be much more the optical, the ocular mode. We look at things. We watch things, we see things, we observe things, you know, and in many ways in meditative practice, you know, we actually encourage this mode of attention initially because it takes us out of the eye of the storm. You know, it's the first step in beginning to observe what's going on rather than being overwhelmed by it. But the third mode of attentiveness, which is often new territory for us, is the experiential mode. And this is where the interest is really crucial in developing skillful attention and actually stepping out of the dissociative mechanisms. You know, if you take a simple exercise, you know, if you hold your hand in front of you, you know, and then, oh yeah, I see it. You know, it's my hand. It's got the parameters of my hand. Looks like my hand. You know. And I can watch it. I can look at it. You know, so I don't have a big story about my hand, but I have enough story about my hand to know it's my hand. You know, but I can watch it. I can observe it. And then if I close my eyes, and you can just try this. If you close your eyes, what is the felt sense of that? Do you get that difference? You get the felt sense of it. It's not a story about it. It's not watching it. Even the idea of hand falls away. You get this very alive, experientially based sense of knowing this as it is, as something that is fluid, that isn't made finite by the story. Okay? This is what we develop meditatively to come out of the dissociative mechanism. We develop that experiential mode that keeps our sense of interest and curiosity very much alive. The thing about this pattern of numbness, of disconnection, is that it doesn't respond well to reassurance or comfort. I wouldn't suggest that you stroke your numbness. You will get more numb. You know, don't just say, oh, you know, and it's not always unpleasant, bear that in mind, you know, it can be quite pleasant, you know, it's not just falling asleep, it's just drifting along in this reverie, you know, nothing really bothers me, nothing's really felt, you know, time goes by really quickly, you know, it's not necessarily unpleasant unless you want to be awake, you know, and then it's quite unpleasant, but it doesn't respond well to, oh, no. Just, you know, numbness. It actually responds well to a little bit more actually discipline and, you know, embodied intention. You know, if you're numb, stand up. You know, do something to actually break that spell. The restlessness and worry. You know, we live in such an agitated world, and we live in such an uncertain world. You know, we live in such an unpredictable world where, you know, so much seems to happen so quickly. And isn't it just so easy to feed on agitation and to really find ourselves moving into that worry mode, you know, of trying to secure our future, trying to secure our next moment, trying to create predictability, trying to create certainty, trying to create safety. You know, and part of this is so human, isn't it? To want to feel safe, but actually to feel that agitation and worry is the mechanism that's going to produce it, again, is going to lead to such disappointment. And have you noticed how infectious agitation is? You know, notice how, just how infectious it is. I mean, just get on a train that gets delayed. You know, and you just feel the sort of, it's like a contagious disease that runs through the entire train. You know, everybody starts to join in, you know. It's just so infectious. But so is stillness. So is stillness. I mean, interesting that the Buddha's response to agitation is so counterintuitive. Where agitation and restlessness and worry tells us to move faster, to do more, you know, to make things different. The Buddha's response to restlessness and worry is so counterintuitive. He says, be still. Be still. First thing to do, be still in your body and get a felt sense of that stillness. You know, feel your feet touch the ground. Feel your hands on your thighs, and your mind will begin to respond to stillness. It's why so much in Buddhist training is actually somatically led and behaviorally led. Change is often behaviorally led in Buddhist psychology. Be still. see how the mind will pick up on the clues of that. The first step in beginning to you know, the Satipatthana instructions, the first instruction is breathe in, calming the formations. Breathe out, calming the formations. And the formations are anything that is agitated in mind and body. Cultivate stillness as a means of calming the agitation. It's like why, if, you know, if the mind body is very agitated, walk more slowly. Find the stillness and let the stillness begin to be highlighted in consciousness rather than the patterns of agitation. I don't know about you, but I've found in my life that there's very little skillful speech or action or response that is born of agitation. That mostly it is born of stillness, and it does, you know, it is something really to be trusted in. You know, that stillness is not flatness. Be mindful of that. It's not about flatness. It's an inner collectedness where we're just simply not torn in 100 different directions. And this is something to cultivate. And isn't it wonderful, actually? You don't need a special set of conditions in which to cultivate stillness. You can cultivate it in the midst of any conditions. And it too is infectious. It is curative. Sometimes it's the only kind of gift of compassion that we can offer to another person who's agitated or, you know, struggling.